Our next case and our last oral argument is A24-1644 in matter of the workforce certificate application of Tech Systems, Inc. Okay. Council, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and Council for Appellant, 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. At the start of your principal arguments, if you could please state your name and a party you represent for the record. This case is being live streamed, but we will maintain only an audio version on our public website. The podium toggle goes up and down with a toggle switch that's kind of waist high. And we are ready for you, Counsel for Appellant, when you're ready.
So, where's the toggle switch, Your Honor?
Kind of waist high, I think.
Okay. Your Honor, may it please the court, my name is Kurt Erickson. I'm an attorney for Relator Tech Systems in this particular matter. I'm honored to be with my co-counsel, Michelle Christie, and my other co-counsel in the audience, David Goldstein. We're here to talk about statutory construction in the first instance and constitutionality, if needed, in the second instance. Outside of the plain language of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and outside of its purpose, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights seeks to examine and regulate TEK Tech System employees outside of Minnesota based on their race, their color of skin, or their gender. That's what they intend to do. That's what they want to do with regard to the employees who are in Hanover, Maryland. To borrow the equal protection paradigm of compelling interest, there is none on behalf of the Department of Human Rights. They have no compelling interest with regard to looking at the race or the gender of employees who do not match up with a statutory exclusive definition of employee in subdivisions 1 and 15 of section 363A.03.
Is this a live controversy anymore? I mean, it's my understanding from the papers that were filed yesterday by the department that Tech Systems has been issued the workforce certificate.
Your Honor, right? Yes. To answer your question, yes, it is a live controversy. 2 points with regard to that. They've made a motion to supplement the record and to dismiss after a meet and confer that occurred yesterday afternoon. We intend to answer that motion pursuant to Rule 127, I think a week from yesterday, which will be on Tuesday. We will point out to the court what we pointed out to the court in our reply memorandum with regard to expedited review. And if you look at footnote 1 in there, we talk about the recurrence of the issue evading appellate review, and perhaps most importantly, the public importance of this. When you see the declarations that we will produce with regard to public importance, including companies outside of Tech Systems that deal with this issue on a day-in and day-out basis, I believe that we're going to follow Judge Lansing's opinion in the 1987 Court of Appeals published case where she said, when we have this kind of an issue, it's not moot.
Let me just ask it this way. You have a workforce certificate now, right?
Correct.
And so what really...
I think that's outside of the record at this point.
I understand that, but if we were to provide you with relief, I wonder what that would be, since you're saying that you want a certificate, which
well,
you
at
have.
A minimum, it would be relief for putting in, for example, and paying fees with regard to the initial certificate, which was denied and continues to be denied. It would be that type of relief with regard to that, but it also would be dealing with this issue on a going forward basis and providing education from the court with regard to whether or not there is a legitimate authority under the case law, under the statutes, as well as under the Constitution for doing what they did.
I'm
just wondering if that would be advisory at this point in time, because
the I don't
certificate's
believe so.
Been issued, you're doing business in Minnesota, you would have to pay the fees anyway because you're applying for a workforce certificate.
Judge, it would not be advisory. First of all, Minnesota follows the rule that if, in fact, there is a recurrence of the issue or a likely recurrence, and if the issue is something that's susceptible of evading review, then it's the kind of issue that would, in fact, be decided, even in a situation whereas here an application for workforce certificate was issued. And I think that that principle, it resonates with a state district court, or should resonate with a state district court even more, because Article III courts, according to Washington versus Harper, the U.S. Supreme Court case, are following that same principle. And if any court was going to not, as you indicate, engage in an advisory opinion, it would be much more an Article III court. And in fact, the Supreme Court has specifically enunciated that Article III courts can and should, in this situation, issue a decision. So to me, that's even more impetus with regard to finding that the issue is not moot.
Counsel, go ahead, Jim.
Sorry, I just want to ask you, so our case law says that for the capable of repetition yet evading review doctrine to apply, there both needs to be a reasonable expectation that a complaining party would be subjected to the same action again. I understand you're making that argument could happen to your client again. And the duration of the challenge action is too short to be fully litigated.
Yeah.
How are we to conclude? I mean, both of those elements need to be satisfied. So how are we to conclude that this could not be fully litigated again?
Well, the argument is whether or not it can evade appellate review from my standpoint. And the argument is exactly what happened in this case with regard to it. In terms of fully litigating the issue, I think that's something that we're going to respond to on next Tuesday when our response to the motion is due.
Okay. So if you want to wait to respond then, that's fine. My other question is, you led off with an equal protection argument, not a dormant commerce clause argument.
Yeah, let me explain.
So the constitutional dimensions of what I thought was before us was the Dormant Commerce Clause, and you're talking about Article
III
courts doing
Judge.
Things, so I'm wondering if you're now making an equal protection argument.
I'm making an argument with regard to compelling state interests for this reason. When you look at the cases that talk about the Dormant Commerce Clause applying with regard to something where the actions and events are completely extraneous to Minnesota, the federal courts are clear that that's a situation where we're engaging in strict scrutiny with regard to that. And strict scrutiny, to an old-time lawyer like me, means the same thing as compelling interest. So we're getting a little bit ahead of my argument, but what I was going to say is there's no compelling interest with regard to the Department of Human Rights examining the race and gender of employees outside of Minnesota.
Can we turn to... I want to understand your interpretation argument, and it will help me understand.
Okay.
If we looked at the statute as it was prior to 2021.
Yes.
Okay, because the rules have not changed.
Yes.
Okay. So prior to 2021, a company that had 40 employees within the state had to file their workforce report, right?
That's exactly right.
Okay. And for companies that contracted with Minnesota that were outside the state, had to either do that or certify that they were in compliance with federal affirmative action requirements. All right? There was A and there was B. Okay. So our statute in prior to 2021 contemplated that an entirely out-of-state company, let's say a Wisconsin company, contracting with Minnesota would have to either give a federal compliance or provide information about their Wisconsin employees to Minnesota. Well, why not? So my question is, it seems like we already contemplated before that an out-of-state company would have to provide information about out-of-state employees if they chose to contract with Minnesota.
2 points. One, I don't agree with the interpretation that you're giving. What we were doing before was we were reporting, even if we were an out-of-state company, we were reporting about Minnesota employees.
That's why my hypothetical is an entirely out-of-state company, okay? An entirely out-of-state company. And this matters because you say that the definition of employee in a statute matters with respect to what information needs to be supplied.
Right.
So if you were a Wisconsin company that had only had 50 Wisconsin employees, no Minnesota employees.
Okay, so you're not meeting the 40-employee threshold.
You have 50 employees in Wisconsin.
No, but...
And you have no employees in Minnesota.
Yeah, so you're
not... And you want to contract with Minnesota.
Yeah,
Even earlier, even before 2021,
right,
that Wisconsin company had to either supply a federal certification of federal compliance. Let's say they don't. If they didn't, the statute required them to provide the information in paragraph A about their employees. And your argument about the meeting of employees seems to me to say Minnesota couldn't even demand that, that they would have to, they could not get information about an out-of-state company even if they were seeking to do business in Minnesota.
Two points. Number one, my understanding of the statute pre-2021 when it was revised was that we were talking about reporting on Minnesota employees. Number two,
But why? That's my question. That would mean that an out-of-state company would have nothing to report.
That's theoretically possible if they would have nothing to report if they have no Minnesota employees pre-2021. And what I refer you to is document number 18, which is the declaration of David Goldstein, talking about this specific situation in terms of who would be reported on and who wouldn't be reported on. When you look at that, again, it's record document number 18, which goes unrebutted.
So this is helpful to me to understand your statutory interpretation argument.
Yeah.
Not your constitutional argument, but your statutory interpretation argument is that Minnesota set up a statute where they would require an out-of-state company with no Minnesota employees to provide reports about their employees, knowing that they would get nothing in return because their employees are not Minnesota employees. There's a problem, I think, with statutory analysis that way.
Well, I would say this in response to what you're saying. One of the issues in your hypothetical is that we have people in Wisconsin making stuff that's coming into Minnesota. Okay, so there's arguably some type of a nexus or connection between Minnesota and Wisconsin, even if, in your hypothetical, there are no employees of the company, Acme Widget, let's call it, in Minnesota. What's different about your hypothetical and what's going on in this case is that the people in Hanover, it's undisputed, have no connection at all.
Why is that undisputed? Aren't they potentially involved in managing and approving any work related
to
Minnesota?
The only people with potential connections for which the department is not interested in terms of doing work are from other states like Nevada and is it Colorado? It's at least Nevada. They're not interested in that.
What if you had employees in Maryland that were performing IT services just like the employees in Minnesota, just doing it remotely?
Yeah.
Could MDHR obtain information about them under your analysis of what?
If they're performing services in Maryland for a Minnesota public service provider?
Right. You have employees here doing the Minnesota work, which you agree to provide information on. Let's say you have employees in Maryland doing the identical work. They're doing it remotely. It's IT services.
Well, I would say this. That's not the situation that we have here.
But as a matter of statutory interpretation, could MDHR...
Well, I would say this.
Require that information.
I would say this. As a matter of statutory interpretation, we only decide the issue that's before us, and we don't decide the hypothetical. In that situation, I would want to examine the nature of the contacts between Minnesota and Maryland, but that's not the situation that's before us. And under the canons of construction, what we're going to do is we're going to interpret the statute consistent with the facts that are presented. And here the facts presented are there's no connection between Hanover, Maryland and Minnesota. That's where we're at with regard to this. Okay. I kind of got off on a... I'm happy to have the questions, Your Honor. Let's talk about this, and it kind of goes to your question, which is, I'm sure that the court is well-versed with the idea that it's an exclusive definition in Subdivision 1 and 15 of Section 363A. I'm not going to beat that horse to death. You already have that argument repeatedly before Judge Case, Commissioner Lucero, as well as in these briefs. That's consistent with the public policy purpose, which is enunciated.
Okay, I would like you to ask, though. But 363A.36 decides who has to provide a report. Where does the definition of employee get used, and what must be in the report in order to support your argument?
Well, let's talk about 363A.0.
Take a minute to answer my question, and we'll have to switch sides here.
Yeah, the answer, well, Judge... If I could, I'd like you to repeat your question to make sure that I'm right on point.
Okay, so I see 363A.36 is saying who must file the information, the workforce analyses, not what they must file. So where is the word employee used? What statute outside of this, statute or rule, outside of this, which governs what must be reported, uses the word employee that we should be focusing on?
363A subdivision 15.
363A.03
subdivision 15.
That's a definition. Where is that term used with respect to what must be reported as opposed to who must report? Do you understand my question?
Well,
you're saying that definition applies to what must be reported?
Here's where your question leads me. To one of my arguments, and if I didn't answer your question after you hear this argument, by all means, cross-examine me. I'm fine with that. 363A.36 does not provide for listing of employees. It only provides for issuance of a workforce certificate. Every single rule that was enunciated in this case, 500 or 5,000 from 23 or 3430, every single rule dealt with the old statute. None of them dealt with dealing with a primary business or a primary business location outside of Minnesota.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Okay, yep, thank you. So you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. And whatever else you have, obviously. We won't hold you to this. You have points you didn't get to. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Rachel Bell Munger, and I represent Respondent, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, and I'm joined by my colleague, Assistant Attorney General Jennifer Moreau. This appeal involves a dispute about state contracting laws and the laws governing workforce certificates that are issued by the Department of Human Rights. It's a privilege for a company to do business with the state of Minnesota, and in turn, the state has decided that it wants to ensure that the businesses that do a larger volume of work for the state and certain public agencies are committed to removing barriers to employment opportunities in the workforce. So covered businesses have to have affirmative action plans and get a workforce certificate from the department in order to do that covered work and receive our public tax dollars. Tech Systems Inc. of Maryland wants to have it both ways, to benefit from being a state contractor and receiving Minnesota tax dollars, while also apparently taking the position that Tech Systems of Maryland does not have to comply with this facet of state contracting laws, and that the state reaches too far by even asking about its headquarters or to require information about headquarters during the application process. The department appropriately denied the 2023 application after Tech Systems refused to even answer the department's question about the headquarters role in state contracts or to provide information about headquarters in its application. So the department respectfully requests that this court affirm the final agency decision. And as your honors are aware, there have been some very recent developments with Tech Systems applying again for a new workforce certificate, providing the Maryland information, and then obtaining a workforce certificate on Monday. I realize this is really close in time to the argument, so that hasn't been fully briefed, but the department, you know, had an obligation to inform your honors of the latest status, and the department believes this makes the appeal moot. The court's not able to grant effective relief. And again, this case concerned the denial of the application. So, you know, if the department improperly denied it, they get their workforce certificate. Now they have a workforce certificate due to their own conduct.
Can we move off that because we will have briefing on that, unless my colleagues have questions. I was asking about what happened in earlier legislation, what difference 2021 makes. I have the same question for you. Under your argument about how the definition of employee, statutory definition, factors in or doesn't into the information that's provided, following your argument, I don't see, well, let's put it this way. Under your argument, it seems to me the agency could have asked for this information under the previous statute. It didn't. Under your argument, it can ask for it now and has. And I think under your argument, it can ask not only for headquarters, but also for, I'm not sure where under your argument the limits are, if any, for the rest of the 4,000 employees. But the practice has changed, it appears, from not asking Minnesota companies for their out-of-state headquarter information and now doing so. So could MDHR have asked for this information? Because the rules haven't changed. So under the rules, could they have asked for this information before the change? What difference does the 2021 statutory change have?
I think the department arguably had authority before. Your Honor's hypothetical about the purely out-of-state company, I think that does illustrate this kind of maybe more longstanding tension between the 363.03 definition of employee and the workforce statutes that are different from other provisions of the Human Rights Act. My understanding is before 2021, the purely out-of-state company had the choice of either doing the federal plan or providing information to the department. But now they don't have that choice. Both out-of-state and in-state are subject to this requirement that they get a workforce certificate from the department.
That seems to be about the only change, right, from 2021.
That's correct. I think some of the statute wording changed a little bit. Yeah. But, yes, now I think the statute, well, before there was that choice for the purely out-of-state company with 40 or more outside of Minnesota at their headquarters. Now it's clear that the department has jurisdiction over both the companies with 40 or more in Minnesota and the companies with 40 or more out-of-state at their primary place of business. And so the department's jurisdiction has expanded. Well, before it was optional, now it's not. They have to apply. They have to submit an application to the department. And I think that jurisdictional piece is kind of important to keep in mind because we're talking about companies that are executing work on covered contracts, you know, over $100,000 with the state, certain state agencies, metropolitan agencies, and with 40 or more in Minnesota or headquarters. And then if we consider that jurisdictional piece and the information that they have to provide under the rules, which is quite broad, you know, about their affirmative action plan, they have to promote affirmative action up through the executive level. We walk through a lot of those rules in our
brief. But why, just pausing for a second, why if you were a Minnesota company before that had 40 or more Minnesota, if you're a company that's out of state that has 40 or more employees in Minnesota, Was the department barred from asking about their out-of-state corporate headquarters? We're describing like, so let's get right to this type of employer or company contractor, I should say.
Right, and this, because Tech Systems was never purely out of, over the time period we're talking about, they weren't a purely out-of-state business since they've had a Minnesota workforce. Yeah. They had a certificate for some time until it expired in 2022. I'm not certain of a company that was purely out-of-state for all that time up until 2021.
Right. And my question is an in-state but an out-state headquarters. The MDHR changed its practice when arguably maybe it could have always asked a company that has 40 Minnesota employees for their corporate headquarters. But it changed its practice. My question is that an unpromulgated rule? That's what I'm getting to
right.
When you change your practice.
No, it's not here. I think certainly there is an argument the department had this authority under the existing, statutory structure and rules. But maybe it's a little more ambiguous. I think there's a good argument they had that. But now the statute is unambiguous that the department has jurisdiction over not only in-state employees, but the out-of-state businesses, too, that are trying to contract with the state. So their jurisdiction essentially expanded. And given that statutory change, have been acting consistently with the statute and their statutory authority. Because Section 363A.3.6 establishes who they have jurisdiction over, and then that works hand-in-hand with the rules of what information has to be submitted.
Right. I mean, you always had jurisdiction over the out-of-state contractor. It's a question of what you ask them for.
Well, I think right. They could just certify their compliance with federal law and not have to go through the department's application process or provide that data to the department.
Do you agree, and I don't want to misstate, and I might be misstating the opposing counsel statement, but do you agree that the facts here are that there's no, that headquarters has nothing to do with the Minnesota, or performs no work relative to the Minnesota contracts?
No, I do not agree
I didn't quote, so don't, if I misstated, but go ahead.
Oh, of course. No, I do not agree. That information's not in the record. They refused to even answer the department's question about headquarters involvement. They didn't provide any information in support of their summary disposition motion or opposing the departments to provide information on who exactly at headquarters is or is not involved with state contracts. We included discovery responses from them to try to get at some of that information, but it's all a little hypothetical because we also are talking about a workforce certificate that lasts for 4 years into the future. But no, that information, I don't agree with that because they didn't provide that information to the department or otherwise in the administrative proceeding. And that's always kind of been the question, right, that the department had that they refused to answer is what is headquarters' role? Presumably they are involved because I don't know why they wouldn't have just told the department no, and then this would have been over, their application would have been processed, the certificate would have been issued. But I don't agree with that.
So with respect to an unpromulgated rule, what's the rule? What if, for example, next week the department decided, under our reading, we think we can ask for all employees of a contractor that has 40 employees in Minnesota and has employees outside. We can ask for everything. Is rulemaking required then? If the argument is the rule always contemplated it, but we're changing our practice.
Well, I think it wouldn't be, it's not an unpromulgated rulemaking issue if the department's acting consistently with the plain language, which is what we argue in our brief, that the department's approach is consistent with the plain language of statute and rules. Again, the statute being focused on companies that execute state contracts of a certain size, of a certain value, and then the rules that allow for broad, holistic information. One thing is reviewing the briefing, too, in Tech Systems' reply brief, I'm kind of left with the question of what do they think the unpromulgated rule is here as applied to the facts of this case? Because it's important to remember how this came to the department was their initial application, which was from Tech Systems, Inc. of Maryland with the Maryland address, but then listing only the Bloomington, Minnesota facility and providing only affirmative action plan initially for Bloomington, Tech Systems Bloomington MN, which isn't a corporate entity. And so the department noticed issues with this application, raised the issue about headquarters, asked follow-up questions. And so, well, yes, we've made arguments about what the department's authority is and what they can do. I think it also is important to take a step back if they were presented with the specific application that they had questions on. It's hard for me to kind of think of, what is the role here when we're dealing with these facts. And how they process this application.
But do you agree that the MDHR changed its practice in any way, pre-21 and post?
There's not a great deal of information on this record since we argue about the current statutory structure. Mm-hmm. But I think I think it is clear. I think the department's authority is now clear, and so I think the department, when they catch this, again, each application is different. A lot of different businesses apply for workforce certificates and might have different locations or operations. But I think when they caught this, you know, under this new statutory authority, yes, they did ask about the out-of-state headquarters.
But does it matter if the, even if there is a change, and so there's arguably an inconsistent application, if the current interpretation, as you just argued, is consistent with the plain meaning of the statute, does it matter for purposes of our analysis of whether there's an unpromulgated rule?
No, it doesn't matter. If it's consistent with the plain language, then there's no unpromulgated rule issue or problem here.
So if you were writing the opinion then for the statutory interpretation aspect of it, I don't take it you're conceding there's any ambiguity in the rules and the statutes that apply. As I've understood your argument, and what I'm getting at, is there any reason, if you were writing the opinion, that you would get to the legislative history?
I don't think your honors need to, because, again, we argue this is clear under the plain language that the department had authority to ask for out-of-state headquarters information and to find out if they're involved with state contracts. And we cite Good Neighbor, the Good Neighbor decision in the brief, that for the unpromulgated rulemaking issue, if it's consistent with the plain language, there is no unpromulgated rule. And again, also taking a step back, not exactly sure what the rule is here, given the posture of how this came before the department, where they're asking questions about the application presented to them.
Well, I think the question that I had that reflects, you know, what Judge Ida is talking about is MDHR seems to brief a lot that the statute matters here, which to me implies that they changed their practice. And it seems like if the rule is all that matters and the rule provides for a broad request for information and MDHR has asked for different amounts, but all of them within the rule, is the doctrine of unpromulgated rulemaking, in your view, simply a non-issue? Because no matter how much you change what you do, as long as it's within the plain language of the rule, MDHR can make those changes without violating the rule of writing, of going through rulemaking when you adopt a practice.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's correct, that as long as they're acting consistently with the plain language of the rule. I think the statute is important here, too, because it does establish who the department has jurisdiction over for purposes of workforce certificates. But yes, if they're acting consistently with plain language statute or rule or both, there's no unpromulgated rulemaking issue here.
Yeah, I should have said the statutory amendment, not the statute, but the statutory amendment.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And I think, too, you know, I think Your Honor raised, there's an argument the department could request more information. And of course, you know, companies, there's some level of companies are expected to be forthcoming with the department about which locations are implicated by a state contract. So each, you know, and some companies may go above and beyond their obligations and what needs to be reported. But the department is, you know, even if their approach is still consistent and authorized under the plain language of the statutes and rules by focusing on asking about the headquarters, asking about who's involved with the execution of state contracts and receiving state funds. And so we do brief that if it's ambiguous and we think those factors do favor the department, the factors used to ascertain legislative intent, but Your Honors don't have to go there because their statutory authority is clear and they appropriately denied the application based on their unambiguous statutory authority. I briefly wanted to touch on one issue raised by counsel. Is I also heard in the opening what sounded like an equal protection argument, which clearly was not briefed here, not preserved for review. They may be trying to shoehorn it in with extraterritoriality, but I want to be clear there's no equal protection claim here. We also do present arguments on how the extraterritoriality claim fails. It's based on a dated view of that doctrine, but even if we are looking at that dated view, the department was only requesting the headquarters data if they had an involvement with state contracts. If Your Honors don't have any further questions, the department would respectfully request that you affirm the final agency decision that upheld the denial of the application.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge, I guess I would start by saying what's remarkable to me is that the department is spending lots of its time talking about how it had authority under the statute, and it's not providing any legal significance to the change that happened in 2021. As I read Chapter 645 of the statutes, we're supposed to attribute something to the fact that the statute changed in 2021, something to the fact that it then specifically identifies for the first time people outside of Minnesota as being part of the test, 40 employees in Minnesota or the primary place of business. From the department's perspective, everything's the same, but it's not. The statute was amended. We have to understand why it was amended. Why was it amended?
Can I just ask you, are you making this argument with regard to just the statutory interpretation or the unpromulgated rule issue?
I'm making the argument with regard to both claims, Your Honor, or both positions. Number
for statutory interpretation, what would you identify as ambiguous about the rule and statutory scheme? Where is the ambiguity?
I don't think that there is ambiguity with regard to the I suppose there's conflict, at least theoretically, between subdivision 15 and the use of the word employee in section 363A.36. But with regard to unpromulgated rules, which I think is exactly the right analysis with regard to this, it's very clear from the unrebutted deposition or declaration of Mr. Goldstein that practice for years, and the Judge Smith alluded to this, was that we don't ask about people outside of Minnesota. And now, consistent with the enactment in 2021, we're now going to start asking for people outside of Minnesota. So it is an unpromulgated rule.
So what do we do within the authority that your counterpart was standing on, which was that if it is consistent with the statute or rule, then it's not an unpromulgated rule. So I want to know, how does legislative history come in for statutory interpretation if you're not really urging ambiguity? How does legislative history come in for unpromulgated rule if it is true that if it's consistent, if the application interpretation is consistent with the statute or rule, then it's not an unpromulgated rule? What do we do with that?
The legislative history comes in this fashion. And it goes to the issue with regard to history. So if we had this power for all this time, why weren't there cases? Well, there were cases with regard to this because we were asking about Minnesota employees for decades. And guess what? No one wants to engage in and pay for litigation when there's no need for litigation with regard to it. So that's why we don't have a bunch of cases under the old statute. The answer with regard to whether or not, let's say the old statute is also asking for that stuff, it may very well be unconstitutional as well, but it's not being challenged because it's not being enforced, according to the analysis that you were having with Ms. Belmonger.
The constitutionality is a separate issue, right? So for an unpromulgated rule,
no.
If the current interpretation is consistent with the current statute, then why do we care what happened before?
The current rules are not consistent with the current statute. Okay. They aren't, because we have a custom and a practice where those things were never asked for. If you look at the declaration of Mr. Goldstein, he talks about how it went for decades with regard to this. The department, in response to questions about past history, refused to provide virtually any past history, none, with regard to this. The department has a blank slate with regard to what past history was in responding to discovery. And in your response to your question with regard to constitutionality, we're entitled to have the regulations match up with the current version of the statute. Undisputed that all of these things about internal audits, about revocation, all of these things were passed under the old statute before section 363A.36 was amended in 2021. There's no dispute about that. So, consistent with Judge Smith's question about do we have an unpromulgated rule here, we really do, in my opinion, and that's a violation of due process, and it's a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause, because we're reaching out to acts and omissions that are occurring, for example, in Maryland or elsewhere, without any reason to do so. You know, with all due respect, the answer to Your Honor's question about is it true that Maryland had no information or connection really with anything going on in Minnesota, The answer essentially was, yes, that's correct. There's nothing in the record with regard to that.
Thank you. Any questions, colleagues? No, great. Thank you very much. Thank you both for your briefing, for your expected briefing, for your oral arguments this morning. We appreciate it. And the case is submitted, and we'll have a decision out in the statutory time period. And with that, we are in recess.